Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Section 1, Article 27 of Pennsylvania's Constitution says the people have a right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. It's known as the Environmental Rights Amendment, and it's the subject of a new documentary that will air on WITF-TV tonight at 8 called Generations Yet to Come, Environmental Rights in Pennsylvania. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick produced the documentary, and she's here to talk about it. Marie, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can reach us on Twitter by going to smarttalk@smarttalkwitf, somewhere along there, @smarttalkwitf. I do it every day, you know? I don't know why. So I just read Section 1, Article 27 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, and it is a unique amendment throughout the country. Not many states that have something like that. In fact, I think Pennsylvania was the first. But tell me why this was added to Pennsylvania's Constitution in 1971.
Well, Pennsylvania has a long history of exploiting its natural resource. Its natural resources, timber, coal, come to mind. People are very familiar with this history. These resources have brought Pennsylvania a lot of economic benefits, but also a lot of environmental destruction. So it was really in the spirit of the 1960s, 1970s era wave of environmentalism that was sweeping the country at the time that a young legislator in Harrisburg decided to try to get a constitutional amendment in Pennsylvania's state constitution to guarantee people the right to clean air, the right to pure water, and to actually make the Commonwealth the trustee of the public natural resources, not only for people living now, but for generations yet to come.
You're talking about Franklin Curry, who was a freshman legislator at the time and became Senator Curry and has appeared on this program many times. But when you talk about exploitation of the environment, and I go back to Representative Curry at that time, it was coal that has probably the biggest legacy of exploiting the environment in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and he said he grew up going to visit his grandparents who lived in Shenandoah, and he was really struck at the time as a child that they lived near a large coal bank and that there was a stream near their house that he said ran black as the Ace of Spades. And he said he wasn't really thinking about law or getting involved in politics at the time, but as a child, he just had this visceral and visual interaction with the destruction that coal mining brings. And in fact, he told me exactly where his grandparents live, and I drove up there to shoot some shots for the documentary, and there's still a huge coal bank right where they lived, and it looks awful today.
And, of course, there's that famous photograph that Representative Curry used in his campaign holding two jars of water, one taken from streams like that that were black and another that was water from the tap. And you can see the big difference. That actually appears in the documentary tonight, right?
Yeah, when he was 29 years old, a friend encouraged him to run for the House of Representatives. So, as you say, he ran his whole campaign was about what he called clean streams and clean politics. And he surprised everyone, and he actually beat this. He was a young Democrat. He beat this Republican incumbent who'd been in office for nearly 30 years. But his whole campaign was about clean environment. And his wife suggested he get this image, and he went to this creek and got this jar of black water, and he put a label on it that said polluted. And then he got another jar of clean water and said clean. So that was his that was one of his campaign images.
But yet, even though Senator Curry was a pioneer and this amendment was, if not the first, one of the first in the country.
It was among the first in the world, actually.
Really? Really? Okay, so worldwide. But it was essentially ignored for 40 years. Why?
Well, it is a very powerfully worded statement. It guarantees people the right to clean air, pure water, and it makes the state in charge of the trustee of these resources. But there were a few cases early on, right in the early 70s, when people were trying to use the amendment, and the courts just really felt like it, perhaps it was anti-development, or that, I mean, when you read it, you're like, sure, that sounds great. But on another level, it's like, well, how can we do anything? Because most of the things we do as humans are disruptive in some way to the environment, building anything, really. So the early cases that were brought under the amendment, the courts just really rejected those cases and actually built a three-part balancing test, a system of judicial review that really muted the power of the amendment for years to come.
But yet, just in recent years, there have been two decisions by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that are credited with revitalizing the original text of the amendment. What happened in those cases?
Yeah, both cases have to do with the Marcellus shale boom. So the first one was decided in late 2013. It's known as Robinson Township versus Commonwealth. And this was because of the Marcellus shale boom and all the fracking. The government, the legislature had passed a new law called Act 13 that really changed Pennsylvania's oil and gas law and updated it and did a lot of things. But one of the things it did was it had this very controversial zoning provision that essentially eliminated zoning for the oil and gas industry. It allowed oil and gas wells to be placed almost in any zoning district, even if it was a residential area. So that was quite controversial. And so the people challenging the law, the local governments, an environmental group, and some citizens, they were challenging several provisions. And among other things, they argued that this new law violated the environmental rights section, Article 1, Section 27 of the state constitution. And when that case was decided, it really shocked everybody in the case, even the people who were arguing it, that the court actually sided with them and wrote this very long opinion about what the Environmental Rights Amendment says, why it matters, why it was put into the state constitution. So it was the first time in late 2013 that the court had nullified a state law using the text of the Environmental Rights Amendment. And then it happened again in 2017. There was another case brought by the Pennsylvania Environmental Defense Foundation. And this one had to do with the way the state was using the money it received from oil and gas development on state forest systems. And a very old law from dating back to 1955 said that they had to use that money they got from royalties exclusively for conservation purposes. And again, the argument was they weren't doing that, and it violated the Environmental Rights Amendment. So in that case, again, the court affirmed a plain language reading of the Environmental Rights Amendment.
I want to play a clip from the documentary. This is Cindy Dunn, who is the Secretary of the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, talking about Pennsylvania and the uniqueness of this Environmental Rights Amendment.
I think people need to embrace it even more than they do. I think people know generally that government's there to protect them, but I don't think they fully understand the value of this amendment to their everyday lives. People in Pennsylvania, I think for too long, accept environmental degradation as the norm. And I think this constitutional amendment really empowers Pennsylvanians to look at a situation and think, wait a minute, you know, if my air isn't clean or my water isn't clean, what's going on? And I actually have a right.
So the question that arises from what Secretary Dunn brought up, is there a cultural political acceptance of the amendment yet?
I don't think that there is. Just anecdotally, in my own life and doing reporting around this, I don't think most people are actually aware that it exists. And, you know, most of us are pretty familiar with the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution and the right to free speech. We talk about the Second Amendment a lot, the right to bear arms. But I don't think a lot of people are terribly familiar with what their state constitutions say. And as I mentioned, Pennsylvania was among the first governments in the world to guarantee its citizens a healthy environment with this amendment. And since the 1970s, actually, about three quarters of the world's countries have added some kind of language into their federal constitutions guaranteeing or discussing a quality environment. And so the U.S. is actually in the minority of countries globally that makes no mention of the environment in our national constitution.
Well, the documentary is called Generations Yet to Come, Environmental Rights in Pennsylvania. It airs tonight on WITF-TV at 8 o'clock. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick produced the documentary. Marie, thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing it tonight.
Thanks, Scott.
And should mention that State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. To learn more, visit WITF.org and click on State Impact Pennsylvania. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania voters seem to be energized for the November 6th midterm election. That's if you go by voter registrations that have increased more for this midterm than any time in the last 20 years. Joining us is Keystone Crossroads reporter Emily Previty, who has reported on this. Emily, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Scott.
All right, I mentioned that this is unique as far as midterms go. When you looked at these figures, what did you find that is unique?
So the unique part was the fact that registrations in the three categories of voters that we typically examine moved in the same direction, whereas they usually do not. So it was up, it's up for Republicans and for Democrats and for independent or third party voters. And normally that doesn't happen. You've got them all going in different directions. Independents almost, you know, so I think it was 13 of the past 20 years increased. But usually you, or every other midterm year since 1998 forward, you have sometimes, you know, sometimes Republicans were going up while Democrats were staying flat, or vice versa, or one was decreasing, the other was flat, one was decreasing, the other was increasing. So this is the first time that all three have moved in the same direction. And when I spoke to a few professors of political science about what they thought that could mean and why that might be, they just attributed it to voter excitement and a particularly intense national political scene, to put it mildly.
You know, we always, you know, in the last couple of years, we have seen many unique situations, things that go against history. In the past, it often, you know, what often happens, and it happens very, very often. I think I remember, you know, it's three times since 1890 where the party of the president in the first midterm after the presidency election actually increased, you know, that they did not send back a legislature that you know, benefited the opponent, the opposite party of the president. So with this one, and now we're just talking about registrations, normally you see, from what I understand from your reporting, that normally you see that the party opposite of the president, in this case Democrats, see an increase in registration for the midterms.
I can't say that about the registration. When the professors, I didn't, so the professors that we spoke with said it works against the president in terms of the outcomes of the elections. So for statewide election results, it was pretty consistent with the party that fared better registration-wise. So that could mean it increased by, it increased while the other stayed flat, or stayed flat as the other decreased. That party that fared better would usually elect a governor and also a senator. And sometimes it happened that they would win the majority of the congressional delegation, but not always. And as we know, redistricting is a complicating factor there. So, they weren't speaking about registration, per se.
As much as they were outcomes.
Results, right.
Okay, I'm glad you clarified that.
Sure.
You did look at percentages for the increases, though, for
the
three areas you looked in. What did they look like?
So Democrats are up by 2%, Republicans by 1%, and independents or third-party voters increased by 4% this year.
Is that independent third party? Is there any kind of trend there?
I mean, other than what I mentioned, as far as the, you know, 13 of the past 7 years, which is way more frequently than the other two major or establishment parties, they've gone up. Usually those increases are more dramatic. Their numbers are smaller. They netted the most. Let me make sure I'm saying this correctly. No, the second most voters. They netted the second most voters This time around, Democrats netted the most. So Democrats added the most as far as registering new voters this year, but they also lost the most, whether that was Democrats switching to the Republican Party, switching to independents, or, you know, people dying or having their registration canceled for other reasons. But they still netted the most.
Emily is with us for about another 10 minutes. So if you have a question or a comment, maybe a theory on why these registrations have gone up the way they have, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right. So we see this as a sign of an energized electorate, that more people do care. And from the people you talk to, what are some of the specific factors of why they're energized?
So, you know, the quote, typical reaction to the president, you know, being of the opposite party, and this being a reaction to that, was part of the Democratic side. You know, they attributed the Me Too movement, the Kavanaugh hearings, which, you know, I mean, I think people on both sides would agree, or, you know, who are members of both establishment parties and have heard people from both perspectives, of course, acknowledge the effect that those controversial confirmation hearings had on the electorate. Now, whether that'll last, that'll carry us through, I don't know. And that's something that analysts have said to me and to my colleague Katie Meyer about how lasting that energy will be. One of the professors, is in terms of like trying to tie it to specific factors, suggested perhaps looking at the registration dates, so dates when people switched parties or registered for the first time, which is something we can do. The Department of State does make the full voter export available online, which includes all that information, including the individual voters' registration date. That is a very large data set, and it's something that we could work with, but not something that I was able to turn for this story with the other campaign coverage going on.
And I don't know if you reported on this or not, but maybe in the course of talking to some of these experts, you know, had them talk about it. Registration, is it any kind of predictor for what turnout will be like?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, and I did want to look at that, but like I said, I didn't have time. What I will say is that I don't know. I would not necessarily expect to find that, only because we see that turnout for midterms is pretty consistently low. We saw the primary election, you know, that was pretty that was consistent with other midterm primaries, which I think, I mean, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We were all very interested people. When I say we, I mean people who are interested in politics and this kind of thing. We're interested to see what would actually happen because of all of the, everyone seems to be a little bit more vocal, whether it's on social media. There's a lot going on that's kind of an anomaly, I guess, nationally, things that happen in national politics, or it seems that way. There seems to be a lot of just divisiveness and intensity around political debates. That's just way more so. I think we can all agree on that. However, that didn't translate to higher turnout during the primaries. So, you know, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll just have to see.
You know, and we're just having a conversation here.
Right.
We don't really have evidence to back this up so much.
Sure.
But President Trump has made this midterm election, I mean, he said so, about him. I mean, a few times he's said, you know, picture it's me on the ballot you're voting for. Mm. I bring that up because that seems to be the biggest factor of what's motivating people to register.
Right.
And to go out and vote and to be energized. And one thing I've noticed for being around for so long is that this is a gubernatorial election. Pennsylvanians are also electing a U.S. senator, as well as their U.S. House of Representatives, the whole Pennsylvania State House, half the state Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But those races are kind of getting lost in the coverage of Trump yes, Trump no.
I guess it depends on what you're paying attention to and where you're getting your news. I would certainly agree that having so much going on at the national level, I don't think that the state house races are getting as much attention as they should be or deserve. That's for sure. And that's just, you know, the reality of limited resources. I do think with the governor's race, that seems to be getting a good amount of attention and focus without making it too much about Trump. I mean, I know the comparisons are there, but I have to say that reading at least the coverage that's been going on by other reporters in Pennsylvania, I think that they've done a good job of balancing that, of, you know, acknowledging the influence and the tie to the president, but then also, you know, providing information that's relevant to issues that are critical to Pennsylvanians.
Coverage is one thing. Media coverage is one thing. Voter engagement is another. Sure. And I guess my observation is that you don't often hear Pennsylvania voters talking about the race for governor unless there's, a controversy, like something that one of them has said, the debate a few weeks ago that really wasn't a debate, that kind of thing. But coverage, I think it's observation that the coverage of the governor's race is probably about the same as it has been in past, elections. But as far as voter engagement, I don't know, just my observation that when you bring up politics to someone on the street or a friend, family member, it often goes straight to Washington.
Sure. Yeah. I think isn't that pretty consistent? Isn't that often how it is? You know, people are like paying more attention to that, maybe more attention to the focus on social issues at that level than they are maybe to things that are more mundane that are happening in their own backyard and have like a direct and immediate impact on their lives. At least that's been my observation reporting on local municipal issues and then, you know, state. So
maybe we're not good observers.
Maybe
of this
we're just surrounded
we are.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
But again, my observation is that I agree with what you're saying. Is it just more so this year that you mentioned politics and right away it's, what's happening in Washington?
I think this is just a continuation of people becoming more engaged during 2016. Absolutely. I think the average person is more engaged, and that's something that started a couple of years ago, started with the last presidential campaign and the lead up to that. And it's continued. Mm-hmm.
Emily Previty is reporter for Keystone Crossroads. You also can see her work in PA Post, papost.org. Emily, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
And I should mention that Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WITF is part of the collaboration with three other public media organizations. To learn more, visit WITF.org and click on Keystone Crossroads. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Lou Barletta will be with us. Smart Talk continues our conversations today with the candidates appearing on the November 6th ballot. We're joined by Jess King, a Democrat running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 11th Congressional District. The 11th District comprises all of Lancaster County and the southern portion of York County. Ms. King, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Now, I have to say that I feel like I know you very well from all the TV commercials and all the appearances I see on TV. And
depending on which side you're seeing, you don't know me at all.
But there may be some voters, since this is a new district with all of Lancaster County, but especially the southern portion of York County, that may not be familiar with you since you are a first-time candidate. How would you describe yourself?
I am a Lancaster County native, a fighter for working families. I spent my whole career in the trenches working to make our economy stronger by supporting small business development, affordable housing, trying to create good jobs in our community, and ultimately decided to step up as a first-time candidate who's deeply committed to the values of this place and to common sense solutions and to making people's lives better, because I have spent 20 years working in a way that increasingly feels like a band-aid downstream from broken federal policies, especially when we're talking about tax policies and healthcare and education. I mean, you name it, we can talk about a lot of issues. But the work that I was doing around trying to create economic opportunity for working families in Lancaster City and Pittsburgh prior to that really felt increasingly challenged in the current context. And when we see policies continuing to exacerbate things like income inequality, tax bills that are giveaways to the corporations and the 1% versus working families and people really living paycheck to paycheck in this country, I decided to step up because I think the only way you change a broken system is bringing your values into it and fighting to make things work better for more of us.
You know, I heard someone say just yesterday, I would not want to run in this atmosphere. As a first-time candidate, what have you learned? What have you observed?
You know, this has felt like a responsibility to step up. This is the system that we have, and I get that it's broken, but I'm a mom, right? So I have two daughters that are 13 and 9, and I think about what our current delegation to Congress looks like right now. 18 representatives to Congress, not one is a woman in 2018. I'm raising two daughters. When I think about the people that I know in my community that are working hard every day to try to make things work, and to not see those values represented in our current delegation and our current representative, it really does feel like a responsibility to step up and to fight the good fight, because there's just so much at stake for so many people and for our climate, you know, you name it. There's just a lot at stake, and it feels like it is a deep responsibility to step into this space, even though it is flawed and broken. We're trying to run a different kind of race and trying to bring our values to it, trying to walk the talk.
Why do you think you'd be a better Congress member of Congress than Lloyd Smucker, the incumbent?
You know, I think there's something about being a first-time candidate, too, to that, you know, my focus is on working families. It's on trying to make our communities better. I've been a public servant for my whole career. And I'm trying to walk the talk with this. So, you know, just the way we're running our campaign, we've gotten more folks involved in the process, more people who are bought into the things that we're fighting for than I think we've ever seen in a campaign in South Central Pennsylvania, potentially in any congressional campaign happening right now in the state. We have so many people who have stepped up to get involved as volunteers, to get involved as donors, to get involved in exercising the civic muscle of being involved in the political process. And rather than just saying, you know, we're going to follow blind party loyalty and just go through the machinations of being part of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party and get the nod from the committee and step up after you serve your term in the state Senate or whatever. You know, this is about stepping up and getting people involved in a political moment that feels unprecedented, right? Where it doesn't feel like our values necessarily are represented in Washington, that things continue to be so polarized. I mean, just look at what was happening yesterday with these mail bombs, right? That is a direct outcome of the tenor of our politics in this moment. And we're trying to walk a different talk, you know, of showing up and actually talking about our values, telling the truth about ideas, telling the truth about things that could actually make people's lives better, rather than falling prey to politics as usual. That is about fear and division. And I think that, frankly, we have to do politics differently if we want to get a different result.
But, and I'm just going to follow up on that, because you talked mostly about how you think that your campaign is unique, but why would you be a better member of Congress, represent the 11th district better than Lloyd Smucker?
You know, I have cast my lot with people. I have lived and worked in economically hard communities for my whole career here in Pennsylvania. I'm a Lancaster County native. I spent a decade in Pittsburgh and a decade back home. I live in Southeast Lancaster City with my family, send my kids to the school district of Lancaster. I'm deeply invested in what it means to understand the challenges of working families in this district right now. The average member of Congress is a millionaire, as is Congressman Smucker. The average member of Congress is, you know, well older than the population at large, and more male, more white, you know, you name it. I think that I'm bringing some things that are rooted in a diverse community and experience serving the community in some of the same things. You know, we have a really nice contrast, I think, between me and Congressman Smucker. He grew up Amish, I grew up Mennonite. We both graduated from Lancaster Mennonite High School. We're distantly related. We both have a background in small business, but we come to things from a very, very different political standpoint and are talking about policies that, you know, are really looking at things from a different perspective. And I think ours is right.
One of the reasons that we do this, and the main reason, is to let the voters hear where candidates stand on the issue. That is what, quite frankly, I would like to focus on with candidates, and we try to get to as many issues as we can.
That's great.
But at the same time, there are some things you can't ignore. And one of them, you kind of touched on it, is that your opponent, Lloyd Smucker, has run a number of campaign commercials attacking you. He appeared on this program earlier this week where he said you're the most radical opponent he has ever faced. Are you, I mean, I think he's talking about that you're the most liberal candidate that he has ever faced.
You know, he likes to throw around labels and rather than talk about ideas. And, you know, based on the movement that we've built, the number of people who are getting involved in the process, I wouldn't say that we are the most radical that he's ever seen. I mean, I am a hometown Lancaster County person. So let's talk about the issues. What are the issues that he thinks I'm radical on?
Well, I'll bring up a few, and then I promise to get on to more issues, which I'd much rather talk about anyway. But you support a group that advocates for legalizing heroin. Do you support legalizing heroin?
Not at all. Not at all.
Where does that come from?
He knows that. I don't know where that comes from. And he's sticking to it. And I think this is part of the reason that people hate politics. People hate Washington. That if this is what it takes to get elected, to tell lies about your opponent that are patently untrue. And he knows that. He knows me. We've met before. We did business before in my prior role as an executive director of a nonprofit, running federal grants. Like, he knows me and my character, and the fact that he's playing this game is a sold-out game to party politics that people don't believe in anymore.
Your salary paid by people in San Francisco that align with former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
So, you know, to run for Congress, we've been doing this. I've been running full-time for over a year, took a leave of absence from my job. The average member of Congress is a millionaire. If we want to have more working families who live paycheck to paycheck, like my family does, stepping up to run for Congress, we need to make sure that people can pay the bills, feed their families, keep a roof over their heads. That's what I'm doing. I'm not lining any pockets. I'm paying my mortgage and buying groceries for my kids. Like, if that's what this looks like, and we scare people away from stepping up to engage in the political process, which is increasingly partisan, increasingly influenced by big money, increasingly influenced by a broken two-party system that is very entrenched. If you want to push up against that, you've got to work in every possible way and really hustle. And so I'm proud having done that. We've also made a really deep commitment to not take any corporate PAC money, because I think when you look at the political process right now and how much special interests influence our politicians and our politics, it's so much about follow the money. See who finances campaigns. So I think what Congressman Smucker doesn't want to tell you is that he has taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from special interest groups, from PACs and corporate PACs. We've taken none. And that this is about how you finance a campaign of the people, by the people, and for the people. We cannot fix campaign finance if we're sold out to those special interests from the time you put your name on the ballot. Like, if we want to change that, we have to run our campaigns differently from the get-go to make sure that people get elected without the help of those special interests so that they can then work to get the influence of those special interests out of our politics.
What he's referring to, and I assume this, I can't speak for Congressman Smucker, is that even though you don't take corporate PAC money, you have gotten a lot of contributions from groups across the country, and that you take a salary with your campaign. Now, what he has done is basically saying the people in San Francisco are paying your salary because of that.
The people in Lancaster County are paying my salary. I've gotten notes directly from supporters right here in Lancaster and Pennsylvania who have said, this contribution goes directly to Jess's salary because I believe in what you're doing. I believe that working families need to step up and run. We actually, as that news came out, we got a spike in local contributions because people want to see more of us, you know, salt of the earth, working folks stepping up to be part of the system. To change the system, rather. Let's put it that way.
All right. So let's talk about some issues. What do you think are the most important issues? You touched on some of these, but most important issues facing the nation right now.
Absolutely. You know, well, there's many, many. And I think what we're hearing when we've done town hall meetings, so we've done more than 50 town hall meetings, which is another contrast with Congressman Smucker. He hasn't had one in-person public town hall meeting to take questions from his constituents. And it feels like he's hiding from us. And what I can tell you, we've done more than 50, and people show up regardless of political party, including people who don't agree with me, who ask hard questions, and I answer them. And what I have seen as the top issue in those meetings at the doors, and we've knocked on close to, I mean, tens of thousands of doors, just 25,000 doors just this past weekend, have made over 500,000 phone calls to constituents in this district to actually talk to people about what matters most. What I hear is the number one issue is healthcare. And I believe that in the richest country in the world, healthcare should be a right and not a privilege. So I've been an advocate of Medicare for All. I'm glad to dig into that with you if you have some questions about that. I know it's been concern for folks in our community that, you know, you shouldn't go bankrupt when you get sick. Our healthcare system is a broken system. And at the end of the day, I think it's about a giveaway to the special interest groups like the health insurance lobbies, the pharmaceutical lobbies that want to keep the status quo because they make a lot of money off of the current dynamic. And we leave millions of people uninsured in this country. We have a lower life expectancy. We have a higher childhood mortality than all of our other peer countries that are also industrialized rich countries. We could change that. It's a political decision. And I say you follow the money on that. So the other things that feel really important to me, we could talk about a lot of issues. Campaign finance, as I alluded to before. I think we need to overturn Citizens United, even if it takes a constitutional amendment. We have to get big money out of politics. We have to make sure that, you know, regular folks can run for office and that the whole process isn't just polluted by special interests and dictated by special interests. I'm an advocate of debt-free public college to make sure that students can go to schools like Thaddeus Stevens College of Technology in Lancaster City or Millersville University and come out without debt. The average student graduates with $37,000 in debt. This isn't free college. This is debt-free to make sure that students can come out without being saddled with debt that they're paying back for generations and then suppressing our growth of our economy where students or recent graduates can't buy houses or start families. We're talking about infrastructure and how to build the roads and bridges and public school systems that create the conditions for a good economy to thrive and grow, including a renewable energy infrastructure to move away from our fossil fuel infrastructure to a renewable one. Because, you know, we saw the report just last week or the week before, the IPCC report about the real challenges with climate change and that it's going to take political will to make this shift. And increasingly, when we have a Congress that doesn't necessarily even believe that climate change is real, let alone caused by carbon emissions, we have got to elect folks that are willing to exercise some political courage to make some shifts in those areas. I'd say those are some of the top issues.
All right. Well, let me follow up on several of those. Let's start with Medicare for All. You said it yourself. Money is one of the most important factors, if not the most important factor in all of this. Now, there are different angles on, you know, money, people making too much or whatever. But the question always arises with Medicare for All is how to pay for it.
There was an
estimate that it would cost $32 trillion if we implemented Medicare for All.
So here's the thing. We have to look at how we're paying for healthcare already. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. We pay twice the average of every other rich country on earth for our healthcare, and yet we get these worse outcomes and leave millions of people at the curb. That's when you're looking at having a private insurance company driving a system driving this. 25 to 30% of healthcare dollars then go to those margins for those health insurance companies, like CEO salaries and corporate shareholder profits, advertising, marketing. And then you're talking about not having leverage to negotiate, which is, by my record, as somebody who spent my career in small business and has an MBA, negotiating for pharmaceutical prices is a negotiating in period for prices. Is a bedrock idea around what it means to have a market-driven approach to things. We actually have a loophole in our current Medicare system that we can't negotiate for pharmaceutical prices. That is a direct giveaway to pharmaceutical special interests that buy off our politicians, including Congressman Smucker, who gets money directly from Merck & Company and GlaxoSmithKline and Johnson & Johnson. Like, follow the money, and you see why people vote the way they do. So we have the most expensive system. We need to shift, not have government control over our health providers. That isn't what a single-payer system is. Your hospitals, your doctors stay independent. You still have your choices, and they still make their recommendations. We're taking out the health insurance industry that makes a ton of money while leaving tons of people at the curb.
So you're talking about eliminating health insurance companies, private insurance, period.
To move to Medicare is the closest thing we have to a single payer system. This is not socialized medicine. This is shifting the way we pay for it. And so we already pay, like I said, twice the average of every other rich country on earth for our health care through premiums, deductibles, copays. expensive coverage for individuals who are self-employed and businesses that see those rates just keep going up. What we get with a single payer system is you throw out all those premiums, deductibles, and copays, and you either have a payroll deduction or a income tax deduction that funds this and ends up being cheaper by far than what we do now. So at $32 trillion, there were some studies that I really wish Congressman Smucker would read this, because I don't think he's actually read the report that was actually funded by the Koch brothers. You know, not the most progressive folks out there interested in progressive policy, but a report that they funded out of Mercatus Center talked about our current healthcare system as it stands would be $34 trillion in additional spending. Medicare for All is $32 trillion. So they directly saw that we could save $2 trillion by moving to this kind of system and actually cover everyone. Right now, there's 27 million people who don't have health insurance in this country, and many others who are underinsured or don't use their health insurance. I hear stories all the time of folks who are like, I have health insurance, but I can't afford to go to the doctor because my copay and my deductible is so high that I can't even afford that.
When you talk about Medicare for All, Medicare right now, one of the reasons that it's pointed to that healthcare cost is what it is when you go to the doctor or you go to the hospital if you have insurance, is that Medicare only pays about 9-13%, somewhere in that range, of what someone would pay compared to what is charged, put it that way, at a hospital, at a doctor. And so what the providers do is make up the difference. That's one of the reasons that healthcare cost is so much more. When you're going to have, if only 9-13% is paid from the government to these providers, there's going to be a lot of money lost. Would you limit doctor salaries, which happens in some other countries? Would you put price controls on what hospitals could charge for procedures? Just how would that work?
I think it's important to talk about the savings overall and what that looks like moving to this kind of system. So there's a lot of ways that this can play out. And I think it's important to note that with healthcare being 17-18% of our gross domestic product, none of these changes happen quickly. None of them happen overnight. That they're going to happen gradually. And already what we've seen with healthcare, there's an urgency to this because it's people's lives on the line. And we know people are losing their lives because of lack of access to healthcare or lack of exercising the healthcare that they might partially have with plans that don't fully cover things. Moving to a Medicare for All system isn't going to happen overnight. And I think that's where we're going to get into all of those shifts as we get into it. But just having some opportunity to negotiate that when you have a single payer system or you move toward that, to negotiate where you have cost savings, where you can find more efficiency from providers, where you can see that. I think that's a lot of that is to be decided. But there are so many countries that have already done this that I think we can look to for guidance, and we see some innovation happening in the medical sector right now to try to, I think, prepare the way for that. I also think it's important to note that when I talk to medical providers and doctors on the campaign trail, pretty much everybody I've talked to is in favor of a single payer system. Like, this is the
approach. They get paid.
Yeah, they get paid. Doctors in Canada actually have great salaries. There was a whole movement recently with doctors in Canada saying that they're paid too much in a Medicare for All system. So to me, I think a lot of the fears that are projected on this are just fears to keep from moving forward. And they're really fears that are supported by the insurance company interests and the pharmaceutical interests that want to keep the status quo.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Our guest during this portion of the program is Jess King, a Democrat running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 11th Congressional District. The 11th District comprises all of Lancaster County and the southern portion of York County. WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. We only have a few minutes left and want to try to get to as many issues as we can. But you mentioned the pipe bombs yesterday, and actually there's another one today that has been discovered. It's a symptom of a divided country.
Yeah.
The Congress especially is divided. I mean, it is unlike any time I've ever seen. As a member of Congress, what can you do?
Yeah.
Say you're elected. What can you do to try to bring people together, to try to agree on issues for the public good?
I think we're already doing it. You know, when you think about how a traditional congressional campaign runs, it's all about how do you find somebody who's wealthy and well-connected who can raise a ton of money from their wealthy and well-connected friends. You know, I'm well-connected, but definitely not wealthy. We've raised a ton of money from mostly in district, and we've also put that to work in building an unprecedented ground game that's engaging with people, that isn't just buying a bunch of TV ads, which is, again, what most congressional campaigns do. You raise a bunch of money, buy a bunch of TV ads aimed at polarizing your bases. We believe that that's a broken game. And what we need to do, so we're running ads that are talking about ideas and vision and where we want to go as a country, not telling lies like my opponent is, like direct patent lies. We have to talk about where we want to go. And so we're actually knocking on people's doors, calling their phones, regardless of party. We're talking to independents, Democrats who don't vote in midterm elections. We're talking to Republicans about our ideas, our values, our vision for where we want to go, people's hearing people's fears. And I think just that act of eschewing a broken, divisive, partisan politics that's telling lies and inflaming fears and a partisan base, and going instead to talking to people of the opposite party about our ideas and saying, you know what, both parties have failed us. Both parties have sold out to corporate interests and special interests. Both parties have failed to see the challenges that working families in this country face who haven't seen a raise in 40 years and are struggling to keep up with the cost of housing and childcare and healthcare and higher education. Like, those are things that the federal government could do to improve people's lives. And when we have those conversations, we win people over. So I take that from as a candidate, and I think, how do we keep that going? To talk to people, regardless of which district they come from or what their politics are, if they share our values in the way we're financing our campaigns to not take money from special interests but to be accountable to people, that, I think, is one key place where we have something in common to move beyond just broken partisan politics.
Is there a Republican you admire, or is there legislation that has been sponsored or proposed by a Republican that you could sign on to?
Yeah, I talk about sometimes that my Republican hero was Thaddeus Stevens. That was, you know, a little while back. He's not currently in office, but he was a radical Republican from Lancaster County who I think charted the way and really stood up to party interests in that moment to talk about how we do really hard things. In his case, it was ending slavery. I mean, what could have been harder in the middle of the Civil War and to really move the needle for so many people in this country to make sure that they had rights around what it means to be an American? That being said, I think that there are, I've had the pleasure of talking to a number of members of Congress, to a number of candidates. What I really want to see, or what I'm most open to, is especially talking to Republicans who have the same values around not taking corporate PAC money. And I've heard, actually, that the Todd Platts, who ran in, who used to represent the York County portion of our district, was a Republican who did not take any special interest money.
And Bill Goodling before him.
Yeah. And so, you know, those are amazing things that we hold in common. I think what we'd find if we were able to sit down today, I know Todd Platts is a judge, but I would love to hear a little bit more about his philosophy. People I talk to, people who are out canvassing for me, deeply supported Todd Platts and said, man, if we could get back to that kind of politics, I'd be so much more hopeful as somebody from this region. And I hold that dear.
We're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And always like to allow the candidates to have 60 seconds or so. It's almost like a closing statement to leave a message with the voters. What would that be?
Yeah, no, I really think we have a choice in this political moment. And yesterday's events showcase this, that a divisive rhetoric that's based on fears and lies to divide us from each other is broken, and we need to reject it. We need to talk about how we build an America that works for all of us and not just the privileged few. How we talk about things that could move people's lives in a positive direction, make their lives better, and how a good government and good representation takes that into account and really works on behalf of the people, by the people, for the people. Like, there's so much about this that feels so elemental that isn't rocket science. It's just about getting involved, having common sense, speaking to the values and concerns of citizens in this place. And I often say, in the course of a campaign, as a mom of 13 and 9-year-old daughters, if I wouldn't say it to them, then I shouldn't say it at all. And I think that's a great thing to live by.
Jess King is the Democrat running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 11th Congressional District. The 11th District comprises all of Lancaster County and the southern portion of York County. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, another candidate interview. We speak with Lou Barletta, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk.